Remaker's Mark, Episode 21, The Searchers. Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in part two of episode 21, where we are again discussing The Searchers. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight? And John Wayne or Clint Eastwood for you?
I am very well, thank you. And Cleavon Little.
Perfect. I believe he played drums for the band, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
No.
All right, I could be mistaken.
Blazing Saddles.
Very nice. Good. That's right. Nice. Indeedy. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you doing? And how about you, John Wayne or Clint Eastwood?
I am also quite well. And between those two, I would probably have to go with Clint Eastwood.
Got it. Lee Hillshire Farms, how are you doing? And what about you, John Wayne or Clint Eastwood?
I'm doing well, and I would have to say Clint Eastwood, just because he's more versatile.
Got it. Mark Josting, how are you? And John Wayne or Clint Eastwood for you?
I'm well, thank you. And I also have to go with Cleavon Little.
Very good.
Wow. Attaboy.
Turns out Cleavon Little is in the lead. Who knew? My name is Kyle Delahunt. I will be your host again this fine evening. And I got to go with John Wayne. I got to say, I like Clint Eastwood. I don't love Clint Eastwood. And I just feel bad that nobody picked John Wayne. And I think he's a good guy. So there we go. I'm sticking with it.
Maybe we're all just John Wayne'd out from this episode.
Yeah, that's fair. I could see that. Agreed.
John Wayne
I'm
fatigue.
Not. John Wayne fatigue. Wayne'd out. So before we move on to our discussion of The Searchers, I want to thank our friends at Modern Antics for their promotional consideration.
Modern Antics produces and markets hugely interesting events in bars and other cool places. New from Modern Antics, Riddle Room. Riddle Room is a live puzzle game unlike anything you've ever experienced. 12 people are locked in the bunker, and they have 1 hour to solve a series of increasingly difficult challenges before the clock runs out. Interested in other Modern Antics events? Check them out at modernantics.com or on Facebook and Twitter at Modern Antics.
All right. Thanks again to Modern Antics. We want to touch on some feedback that we got on Facebook and Twitter. We put a call out to see who, if anybody, we thought could replace John Wayne in a remake of this movie. Is John Wayne replaceable? Is that possible? And a friend of the show, Becky Baltich Nelson, said, "No, it is not possible!" Exclamation point. She also said, "For your next Western, watch Rio Bravo. It is the best." And I said, kind of behind the scenes, that we had talked about kind of being 50-50 between Rio Bravo and The Searchers, and The Searchers ended up winning out. And I said, I listened to the song My Rifle, My Pony, and Me, which is from Rio Bravo. It's Ozzie Nelson, I think, from Ozzie and Harriet. And I can't remember who else. Dean Martin singing it. It's a great song. You should listen to it. Anyways, and she replied saying, My Rifle, My Pony, and Me was the song my pops and I danced to at my wedding. Oh, and if for no other reason, Rio Bravo should have won out because of Walter Brennan. So maybe we'll have to revisit and do Rio Bravo at some point here. But that's a great movie, and everybody should listen to My Rifle, My Pony, and Me. And that's very sweet about the song. That's awesome. So thanks for that feedback, Becky. Jerry, you got quite a few responses on yours. You want to touch on those briefly?
Yeah, it actually kind of sparked a discussion about actors in general. And Brent Johnson, a good friend, said, I think Tom Hanks is our Jimmy Stewart. Matt Damon is maybe our Humphrey Bogart. Leonardo DiCaprio is our Marlon Brando, which is interesting. But the Duke, who is the Duke? And he surmised potentially Will Smith.
I thought he was more of a prince.
Odd choice.
Wow. Nice.
And then he went on to say, where does Robert Downey Jr. fit in? Is he our Kirk Douglas, our Charlton Heston? And then Debbie Peltier Hambrick said, Harrison Ford is, presumably talking about John Wayne. Tony Mayer, who has frequently contributed to the show, said Jeff Bridges seems like a natural fit given that he's already stepped into one legendary Wayne role. And he also said that he could see Robert Patrick as a badass old cowboy, which I tend to agree.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Emily Waster said Josh Brolin, which we did talk about already. And Jonathan Lee said Timothy Oliphant.
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 I don't know.
Or in the joking discussion that he and I had, Rowdy Roddy Piper.
That's a win-win. Agreed. Totally. And then on Twitter as well, we put a call out, and our friend Clarence Weathern, who's at C. Weathern, said, I just watched that for the first time. This is tough. Maybe Daniel Craig, Hugh Jackman, Clive Owen, if American, maybe Clooney. So lots of good picks there. And then Derek, who complimented me on having pronounced his last name correctly thus far. So I'm going to pronounce it completely incorrectly this time. Derek Shillelagh. Although I think it's Chili, who is at Windy Apple. I have not seen this or indeed many Westerns. Based on the synopsis, Tom Hanks, Sean Bean, although both seem too old, maybe Sam Rockwell. So Derek, good picks there. I like that. Sam Rockwell would be really interesting. I like that. He's almost in our Hall of Fame, sort of not being able to pick. But we have yet to rule him out just yet. But yeah, and I like Sean Bean a lot too.
I briefly thought of Hugh Jackman when I was thinking of John Wayne's.
As did I.
Good stuff. And then I also want to give a quick overview of the casting picks for the first part, wherein we recast three major roles and one minor role was the winner out of five. The major roles, Scar, originally played by Henry Brandon. We went with Andy's choice of Javier Bardem. The role of Marty, originally played by Jeffrey Hunter. We went with my choice of Chris Evans.
Yay.
The role of Ethan, originally played by John Wayne. We went with Mark's choice of John Brolin. And then for the minor character,
maybe John, Andy. Josh Brolin.
John.
I'm sorry. John Wayne. Yeah, that's right.
Josh Brolin.
Right.
You said John. You said John Brolin.
So for the minor character,
no more
the
role of.
Come on, John Wayne, Josh Brolin. I've had a lot of water. Everything's fine. Guys, back off. Josh
no more water
Brolin.
For you then.
James Brolin it is then. Perfect. Then for the minor character, the role of Mose, originally played by Hank Warden, who, bit of trivia here, who played the sort of bumbling hotel servant in Twin Peaks who finds Agent Cooper on the floor at the end of season one. Kind of similarly goofy. Anyways, we went with Andy's choice of Paul Rubens for the role of Mose. So good job. So Andy was the big winner. Congratulations. Yay. There, Andy. Well done. Happy for that. However, again, going democratic with the choice of movies here, we're going alphabetical. And up next after Andy is Jer. So Jer, let us know the movie that you are picking for our next discussion.
I am thrilled to announce that our next movie will be back into the 80s and back into the realm of comedies and back into the realm of Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, and Martin Short, The Three Amigos.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy.
A movie that Andy deemed unremakeable.
That's right.
If you will.
I'm sure that won't come up in the discussion.
Not one bit. Not at all. What was the name of that special episode? I can't remember.
I think it was just called The Three Amigos is the best movie ever made.
Yeah, that could be it. So you could be wrong, and I'm pretty sure you are, but
I think
it's something
it was called
like that.
You Can't Touch This or something.
That's
like
it.
That.
There you go. You
the Can't Unremakables.
Touch This. Yeah, The Unremakables.
Unremakable. No, that's what you are.
Nice.
I'm also convinced that there will not be any singing during the Three Amigos episode.
Yeah, that's so slim to none, the chances of that not happening.
Myself especially, apologize in advance.
Don't scare people away just yet. That'll be a fun one. I'm excited for that. So good pick, Jer. Okay, so that wraps up our summary of the first part and the feedback, and now we move on to the second part of our discussion of The Searchers, wherein we talk about plot, tech, and filmmaking changes that we would make to The Searchers. The first thing that we talked about is, so the original was made, I believe, in 1956. So this is a time of, you know, some racial sensitivity, but not a lot of that, especially when compared to today. And in the original, the Indians are portrayed with pretty broad strokes. The Native Americans are portrayed with pretty broad strokes. I don't believe that there's a complimentary word said about the Comanche Indian tribe in the entire movie. And it seems like in reading up on the history of this film that this movie was even seen as being pretty callous when it came out. So even in its time, which was not a super welcoming, super open time in a lot of ways in terms of racial sensitivity, it painted pretty broad strokes even for that time. So for our remake here, we wanted to talk about, you know, ways that we could do this differently, that we could have a good villain, that we could have a group of people who, you know, whether they be the Comanche Indian tribe or somebody else, you know, lots of different options there. But how could we do it that maintains that good villain, that maintains that presence, but does it in a way that is not disrespectful? So I think that that is certainly a challenge. So what do you guys think? Do you have any suggestions as far as different ways that we could do this? I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do in terms of sensitivity, but do you have any other ideas that we could do in terms of sort of increasing racial sensitivity in this remake?
One idea that I had in coming up with my sort of revamped story and thinking, oh, maybe the space opera would work, the space Western, and referring specifically to Firefly, they kind of make up their own villain in The Reavers, which is sort of like a zombified, crazy people. They don't really get into a lot of specifics, but they speak of them not necessarily in racially insensitive tones, but they're certainly not complimentary towards them. And they paint them in broad strokes, but, you know, maybe it's accurate, but they also just instill a lot of fear of that character, that mass character of the Reavers. So one option would be if the story was remade, you know, really, really differently, that instead of it being a known group from history, like, you know, the Comanche Indians, that you could just kind of make up your own new adversary that doesn't have an historical context to it already.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. It also kind of harkening back to my not so positive feedback about Cowboys versus Aliens in the first half, where I called it capital B, capital A, little case D, bad. I think that's a really interesting idea. And when I first saw the trailers for that, when I first read up about it, it seemed really interesting. And I just didn't enjoy the execution, but I like taking some of the sort of the tropes of the Western and mixing it up a little bit. I think that's an interesting way to think about that. I like that a lot. You know, in the original, most of the attitude, I think it was prevalent throughout, but most of the attitude laid within the role of Ethan. So I think that maybe we could have that character have nearly as strong of beliefs, but maybe have more people to offset that, because there's nobody that really calls him on it. You know, nobody's just going to say you're being racist, Ethan, you know, in the original. But, you know, maybe, you know, you could start to see the viewpoint of these other peoples, of their way of life. You know, I think even something as small as when he accidentally marries the Native American woman, much of what she does is played for comedy. You know, like even goes as far as like shoving her. I mean, it's really kind of gross that way. But, you know, that could be an opportunity for them to see, like, this is a human being. This isn't someone who is lesser. It's just a different person, you know? So that would be something that I could see, is just rounding out the people whom they are chasing a little bit more. It doesn't mean that I think that would lessen, it would lessen the potency of the villain. I think if you cast a really good villain, it'll still be really scary. But I think it, you know, there's some discussion, they don't mention it specifically in the original, of sort of that Stockholm syndrome sort of thing, where Natalie Wood's character, Debbie, doesn't really want to leave, or she's not, at first it doesn't seem like she wants to leave. Ultimately, she decides that she does, or she makes that decision. But, you know, you could see why she wouldn't want to. Some of that is fear, but some of that could be that is the reality that she knows and she has survived. You know, maybe she's happy in some ways, where in the original it was portrayed in a way that was almost not possible. Like, there was no way that she could be happy or well off at all in that tribe. So what do you guys think about that?
I tend to agree that, I'm sorry, I should specify. I tend to agree with the thing that you said like 5 minutes ago.
But, me too.
That, you know, short of moving the setting out to space, probably the best way to nullify the racism aspect of the story is to humanize the Native Americans and really just establish motive. Because in the original film, there's none of that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, all there is the white man saying, this is a murder raid. They kidnapped these girls. We got to go get them. And that's it.
Yeah.
And there's really no perspective at all from the Comanches. And, you know, trying to get inside their head a little bit, is really going to move all the insensitivity onto the characters themselves instead of, you know, the film.
In similar fashion, creating the character of Scar as the bad guy and separating his role from that of the Comanche culture in general to kind of take it away from the broad strokes that it was in the original and not, these are the Comanches, they're the bad guys, and instead put it on, this is Scar, he's a bad guy, and showing a little bit more of the Comanche culture and, you know, they're the same thing you guys are saying, and showing the day-to-day life and that they're just trying to, you know, they're just trying to live and live their lives the same as anybody else. But there just happens to be this one guy who happens to be Comanche who's, you know, a little bit crazy and mean and evil and likes to do bad things, and putting a lot more stock into that one character as opposed to the culture that he's from, and making him the antagonist instead of them the antagonist.
Yeah. One other idea that I had was, and this would be changing the plot quite a bit, but we could have them kidnap, sort of intern, you know, try to capture Debbie, but end up kidnapping someone else from the tribe, and have that essentially take the place of the woman who Marty accidentally marries. So you could have them have this person in tow that you could then, you know, that could be someone who helps portray that humanity of their people, you know, that could really do that. You know, the original, that character did not do that at all. I think it largely reinforced stereotypes. That person could be somebody who could be very strong, could be somebody who's very independent, could be somebody who, you know, could potentially speak well of the tribe and talk about their intent. I mean, that could be really interesting. I think that would be a good sort of twist in that. I think it would remove a character that in my mind didn't do a whole lot for the original. I mean, I think that would change the Lori character's plot line a little bit. But I'm okay with that. I think that's all right, because I think that would be a good strengthening of that portrayal overall.
I think one option to maybe mitigate or somehow offset some of the racism that Ethan portrays is if there was a little backstory to explain why he has these feelings towards the Comanches, that maybe mm-hmm. he was personally wronged somehow. So there's a little more justification for his hatred, or maybe not justification, but explanation, context, or to have some other development where he has, you know, there would be interesting conflict. Like, let's say he had a romantic relationship with a Comanche woman at some point in the past. So he has this conflict within him of, you know, this kind of, maybe it's socially, this kind of socially expected and accepted hatred of the Comanches, but then he has this personal struggle within him. And so that almost manifests as further hatred of the Comanches, you know, a little almost maybe like a self-hating kind of a thing. Just something that provided a little extra understanding of why he feels the way he feels.
Similar to how I have a distaste for New Jersey.
Well, the thing about that, though, Mark, is
I would like to draw on Mark's experience with New Jersey for this character.
That's completely justified and true.
Yeah, New Jersey sucks. That's true. I'm kidding. I've never been there. I don't know.
And my experience with Estonia.
I've been to Jersey. It's all right. Andy, you talked a little bit about historical accuracy, and we've touched on that a little bit here, but not just in the Comanche Indian side of things, but kind of some other portrayals as well. You know, you talked about the depiction of Moe's, for example. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, too? And I think this goes back to what we were saying. You know, is the racism or just the depictions of all the characters individually and collectively is it accurately depicting how those characters, those peoples were portrayed in that time, and this is, you know, post-Civil War era, or is it more a product of the 1950s? So the racism, or maybe a strong word, maybe it's not, but the opinions and feelings towards the Comanche Indians were probably to some degree accurate. I think they may have been sharpened for the purpose of the movie.
That's a great way to put it.
But I think you know the Texas and Indian Wars was a real series of conflicts. This was a real struggle that was going on between the cattlemen in Texas and the Comanche Indians who were native to that area. So that was not a made up conflict. Moving on to Moe's, if you haven't seen the movie, it's really hard to describe how he is depicted. You know, the classic term would be someone who's mentally retarded, perhaps. That's not really an accepted term anymore, but someone with a lot of developmental delays or disabilities. He has a lot of cognitive impairments, and that is kind of how I interpreted it.
Moe's, how far is the river?
I've been baptized, Reverend. I've been baptized.
Shut up, you old fool.
Thank you kindly. Thank you.
And you better get yourself set.
Like I said, in the earlier episode, he kind of talks in nonsense a little bit. He can understand and have a conversation with you, but he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But they portray him. There's a scene early on where Ethan literally kicks him in the rear to, you know, do some chore. Like, it made him seem like he's a servant rather than a peer, even though he's part of this posse that's searching in the first part of the movie. But then later on in the movie, he's depicted as a very much well-loved kind of member of their little community, where he talks about all he wants is his rocking chair. He wants to sit in the rocking chair, and they make a big deal about, oh, let's get him his rocking chair, let's let him sit down. But they also treat him like they treat him like a child almost all the time. So
yeah.
I was curious to see or to hear other people's thoughts about where that fits in. And back in the 19th century at that time, there wasn't a lot of, you know, mental health going on, especially in the plains of West Texas. You know, so that probably wasn't too far from accurate, but it's just interesting how they almost kind of make him out to be the court jester of the movie.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I think that they largely looked upon him with some degree of like kind of town idiot with like a little bit of pity, but it's not quite so negative as town idiot.
But it kind of is though at times. Like, but it's like he's a town idiot, but he's our town idiot.
Yeah,
you know, so they're protective of him in that sense, but certainly only to a certain point.
It's more on the pitiful side of things. Like, yeah. I think they pity him more, and I think they watch out for him more. You know, it's interesting because he does kind of go off on his own. Like, I wonder how he got to the cantina that they end up at, where they, you know, end up kind of recruiting people to take them to Scar. Like, how did he get there? Did he just like wander off?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they never explain sort of how that happened. So, I mean, he does still have some independence. So how much of it is sort of brought on by being out and kind of going through a lot, and how much of that just is true lacking in development in that way? But I think your point in terms of historical accuracy versus sensitivity in portraying that, I think it could be done better, although I don't think Moe's was terrible in the original. I think there was a sweetness there that I think sort of, and I think a lot of that is in the portrayal of the character. I think he portrayed him very well in that way. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a tough one.
Andy, would you say that he is, through today's eyes, an offensive character?
I would say that, yes. I think that's fair to say that he is depicted in a way that I think people would see it as insensitive today.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'd agree with that.
Yeah, it's interesting how things like that change through the years, whereas I'm sure in the 1950s, he was definitely not trying, you know, that character wasn't, let's make a really horribly offensive character. It was more, we need somebody that's going to lend a little bit of levity to this movie and some comic relief, and let's make kind of a goofball. And
well, they may have even said like, we need a town idiot character. And that was like, okay, let's, here we go. This is it, without even giving it a second thought.
It's interesting how the times they are a changing.
Indeed. So sort of tying into that, this was our first Western discussed here on Remakers, Mark. So not a lot of us, I mean, Lee, it sounds like you've had more than anybody here. And I think that's in terms of historical movies as well, or movies of kind of olden eras. But, you know, this was our first dabbling into this genre. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the genre and sort of how it has been throughout time. So Lee and Jer had some things to talk about that. Lee kind of specifically in terms of its place in film history, and then Jer in terms of kind of how it fits as far as the archetypes of the Western. So Lee, do you want to talk a little bit about that to start with, and then move on to Jer too?
Yeah, you know, it's considered by a lot of film historians as being one of the definitive Westerns. And in fact, when I was in college and taking like a film analysis class, we were talking about the different genres, and this was cited for when we were talking about Westerns. And the teacher, we didn't watch the entire movie, but she did show us that final shot where Ethan stands in the doorway and everybody's home. You know, everybody has come home. They've rescued Debbie and everybody goes inside, but he comes up to the door and he stops, just kind of stands there for a little bit. And then he turns around, walks away. And that was explained to me that that is a perfect representation of what a cowboy is in American cinema, because he's very much a loner and he can't partake in like a normal pedestrian life. And that's summed up perfectly in that scene. And that's why it's so iconic, that image. And, you know, like any other genre, the Western genre has its rules. So I guess I'm wondering how we honor that in a remake without it being cliche. I guess one of the ideas that I had was you really can't. So what about just changing the setting a little bit? And I talked about this a little bit in part one with my casting of Benicio del Toro. And maybe instead of a Comanche Indian tribe as being the antagonist, you know, maybe it's outlaws that kidnap Debbie or something of that nature. I don't know exactly how that would play out, but that might create different problems with racism. But I don't know if anybody has any other thoughts about that and, you know, what direction we could take a remake that would, I guess, give it a fresh look.
I think if we just make a really good movie, I think that would be enough. I think that the Western genre is interesting, and I think it could be made, and if it is done in a respectful way and sort of understanding the tropes of the Western, understanding what made the characters well-known and well-loved, and just tapping into that in a well-written, respectful way, I think that could succeed without being cliche. I think if you don't like Westerns, doing that would not make you like Westerns. I mean, I think there's been a lot of attempts to try to diversify Westerns, to try to do different things. And I think, Jerry, you're going to talk a little bit about that. But those, I don't think they've been successful in reinventing the Western for a modern audience. I think it still is a little bit of an outlier in a lot of ways. But I think if in a remake we are true to that, people might not love it, but it will be true to the form and that will be sufficient. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I don't know. Like getting back to the racism topic, you know, what Mark said about, you know, making it more about the one person being the antagonist and not the group. I think that was done to a certain degree in Dances with Wolves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it starts out where Kevin Costner's character is very much prejudiced against, you know, the native population, but comes to understand them and actually become one of them. So, I mean, I think it's been done, and I thought that was done really well. So, yeah, I guess there's ways to do it.
I think it's possible to have the Comanche tribes can still be the antagonist, just portrayed in a little more objective light, maybe shedding more, like I was talking about earlier, a little more context, maybe not necessarily on Ethan, but just on the overall conflict between the cattlemen and the Comanches. Like, why are they at odds in the first place? And you might see, oh, it's because the cattlemen are moving in on their native lands. And if you were, you know, in their position, you'd probably be pretty angry as well and things like that. So and I think it could still be done with historical accuracy without being inflammatory.
Yeah, I think the Western tends to put a magnifying glass on universalities in a very particular setting. So what makes it a Western is a little bit broader brushes in terms of good versus evil. I think that's okay. I think that speaks to what you were talking about, Andy. It just happens to be set in kind of a desert in a Western world. You know, I mean, that's where it gets its name. So, I think that those universalities, when done really well, when written well and made well, that can speak to so many people that then you could find correlation or similarity between your environment, whether that environment be a modern city, a suburb, urban, you know, maybe you truly live in the West, or maybe you can find something in your life that is universal to the slightly broader strokes that are portrayed in a Western style movie, regardless of the setting and regardless of the villains or heroes, that you could find something to tap into for that.
I think to get back to Lee's question about how we can honor the genre in a remake, I think a lot of that rests on the portrayal of the cowboy and how John Wayne, especially in this particular role, but most of his Western roles to one degree or another, really encapsulated what the cowboy was as a mythology, as a character, as a hero. And I think that as the Western itself evolved and changed for viewing audiences, I think that character, that archetype changed from the spaghetti Westerns and Clint Eastwood, where he's more of just kind of a no rules, almost a bandit, almost a bad guy, where he doesn't really have any type of moral code, to the 80s and 90s, where it was, you know, the cowboys were more just rock stars. It was Young Guns and it was The Quick and the Dead and things like that, where they were just like they were the celebrities of the day. And again, there really wasn't any kind of moral code to them. They were out to have fun and party and shoot their guns and whatnot. And then the current Westerns, or the newer Westerns, things like Unforgiven, which was a great movie, kind of got back to that cowboy code, so to speak. And then,
yeah.
And then it's been a lot of remakes like 310 to Yuma and True Grit. And then even the sort of new Westerns like No Country for Old Men, which is Western in a lot of ways and a lot of feeling, but there, you kind of get back to that sort of cowboy archetype. But I think in order to really do justice and to really give credence and honor to what this movie was and to who John Wayne was, I think you would really need to refocus on what the cowboy was, not historically, but cinematically, and what he meant to people two generations ago, and what that character type was.
Yep, those are really good points. Jerry, you also threw in a question there of why don't people like Westerns these days? What do you have an answer to that? Was it a rhetorical question?
Well, we kind of talked about it in pre-production a little bit more, and I'm not going to take credit for this thought because I'm sure it was one of you guys, but one of the things that we had talked about was in the 1940s and 50s, there were the radio dramas with the Lone Ranger, and there were you know, Bonanza and John Wayne movies. And I mean, that was kind of the hero of the day. That was what kids played when they went outside to play, is they played cowboys and Indians. And that's not really what's pervasive in our culture anymore. Kids don't, I'm sure a 4 and 5 year old aren't even going to know what playing cowboys and Indians really means anymore. I mean, they're playing other archetypes, other types of, you know, good versus bad, and it's, you know, Transformers, or it's, you know, robots fighting giant lizards, or, well, maybe they're not doing that, but
no, they do that all the time.
Is that what you guys are teaching?
Yeah, that's what I teach to everyone I meet.
That's a good dad right there.
But I don't. It's just not as pervasive in the culture, and so I think the reason people don't like Westerns is that there aren't Westerns. If that makes sense.
I think we're going to come back to it.
I could see that. Yeah, I think it will be hard, but I think it's possible.
Yeah, I mean I think the Western went away because of the course that Jer noted. That's it. Kind of the Western kind of ended up at the same place where the Fast and Furious movies are.
The Western went away because of Mountain Dew.
Okay.
What?
But yeah, so I think they went this way of cheap thrills for a while. And there are really, really good Westerns that have been made recently, but it's by really intelligent filmmakers. And, you know, whether or not you like Quentin Tarantino, you have to admit that Django Unchained was a very original movie. And, yeah. But, you know, how often can you make There Will Be Blood? You know, that's, you can only make that sort of movie so many times. But, the point is that there are some really, really good Westerns that have been made recently. And with the really, really good remakes that have been made recently as well, I think it's going to come back. I think people are going to start to catch on to the genre again and start to tell original stories.
I think another reason that it has lost its potency is that in the 1940s, there still were cowboys. I mean, the old West was still, it was basically gone. It was basically gone, but there were people that remembered it. And it was kind of the folklore of the day. You could tell stories about the old West, and it was a generation removed. And we're so far gone from that being an actual place that all we know about the old West is largely, you know, the movie version of it.
No, there's still cowboys now, but
there still are cowboys now, but they're not John Wayne roping and wrestling and things that John Wayne did.
Yeah. Fighting giant lizards and robots.
I must have missed that one.
And robots. John Wayne is actually going to be in Pacific Rim 2.
Nice. Looky here, kaiju.
A CG yes. John Wayne.
CG John Wayne.
With Klaus Kinski.
Wow. In. I'm entirely in for that. Nice. Yeah, that's a good discussion and good points, Chair. I like that. So the third thing is talking about kind of the performances and the sort of larger than life to the extreme of Rock a Mic Like a Vandal sort of performances. So Andy, do you want to talk about that? And then I'll talk about some kind of strange mood stuff too.
I just kind of want to hear you do a little bit on the ice a little longer.
Light up a stage, wax a chump like a candle.
Dance. Thank you.
Rush a speaker that booms.
That was nice. I mentioned this in the first half of the episode about how Jeffrey Hunter, who originally played Marty, came from the same acting school as Jeffrey Horn, who played, I should have looked up his name, his character's name, in Bridge on the River Kwai.
Lawrence Fells.
Lawrence James Chesterton. Hold, please. Kudos. Bonus points to anyone who gets that reference.
Oh, man. Yeah. I should have picked that one.
Well, hey, next time around.
I'm going to put that on the list.
Lieutenant Joyce.
There we go.
So, getting back to our original point here. Jeffrey Hunter is to John Wayne, meaning Marty is to Ethan, what Jeffrey Horn was to William Holden, meaning what Lieutenant Joyce was to Commander Shears. Commander Shears?
Works for me.
We'll say commander, meaning
major
that
commander,
he
no rank Shears,
general major over under, meaning that he was this hyper mobile, hyperactive secondary male character to a stoic man's man leading man.
Why, you just stake me out there like a piece of bait. You wouldn't build up the fire. You fixed it so I could get my brains blown out. What if you'd missed?
Never occurred to me.
And it was this odd kind of phenomenon, I think, of the 50s where you had, I don't know if the directors were just saying, hey, you secondary guy, more, louder, faster, quicker. And hey, you main guy, just settle down. Because that's what it felt like. And it's hard for me to watch those kinds of performances and not be like, tee-hee, he looks so silly. Because I felt like he looked kind of silly. And it just made him seem whinier and... like they're on, like they just down about 6 cans of Red Bull and they're just going to town. Red Bull and Pixie Sticks, I tell you.
So there's no sugar in Pixie Sticks.
So that's my take on that one. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that
is it even worth discussing?
Neither Red Bull nor Pixie Sticks exist in the 50s.
Prove it.
They did have opium.
Fair enough. Good point.
They had amphetamines. Probably, I assume.
I assume so. Yeah, I think some of that is stylistic and I get that, but it does feel really out of place when placed next to sort of that glacially stalwart John Wayne.
I mean, the contrast is just astounding.
Yeah.
Agreed. And it could be intentional to bring out this toughness of the main role, and that could be, but sometimes it just gets annoying. You just want to smack him.
Yeah. What I couldn't tell is whether it was a bad actor or that was how it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, like I didn't know if Jeffrey Hunter just overacted or if that was truly like, if it at the end of that take, whatever take that might be, John Ford went, great, that's the one, you know, like I just don't know. I assume so. I mean, John Ford's a pretty discriminating director and very well respected and very well known, but yeah. You know, I don't know if that, you know, if there's the Jake Lloyd effect where it's like, all right, that's the best we're going to get. Let's move forward. We'll think about that. You know, he got all his lines. He didn't miss any words.
Way to pull a Jake Lloyd reference.
Nice work. I think Kyle, you're right. I think there is a large stylistic contingent to it that was just how things were done at that time. But man,
well, I think that if you look at a lot of movies in that same time period, especially movies, especially comedies, and Marty's role may have been an attempt at some comedy in a more serious movie, but there just seemed to be a lot of. And maybe this is people coming out of the silent movies era where you needed to be expressive with your whole body and your face and everything was overly exaggerated. But it just seemed like that happened a lot. I mean, if you look at a lot of movies in that 1930s, 40s, 50s, people were shaking their heads and throwing their arms and talking with their mouth really wide. And it was just, nowadays it looks absurd, but I think that was just kind of commonplace because that's what people were used to seeing.
Yeah. I think, you know, thinking of what we can use now in terms of filmmaking styles to ramp things up, to increase intensity. I mean, there's like a very active camera, there's faster editing. Neither of those things were hugely possible back then. So I think that was an instrument that they had to play with. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. they had that in their arsenal and that was something that they could do. You know, thinking about something as prevalent in this movie, but kind of silly where it's like the scenes where they had horses running, like it was, or, you know, they did this for car chases back in the day too, where they like sped up the film ever so slightly to make it seem more exciting. You know what I mean? It wasn't like double speed, but it, to me, it felt really like fake, you know, it felt really weird. But then I'm sure that felt more ramped up, more intense. You know, you felt probably more in that mode. So you had to think about kind of like what they had to deal with what options they had to kind of up the intensity a little bit. And that was a choice that they made to do that.
Pre-BH.
Pre-BH?
Pre-Benny Hill.
Yes, exactly. That was the tipping point. Yep. And since then, yakety sax. Yep. Another thing that we talked about was kind of the mood shifts. So the original had really, you know, it's a pretty dark movie in content, in a lot of performance, you know, in terms of the kind of hyperness of the acting that we talked about. Again, that's kind of in line with the time, but there were like very bumpkin-ish characters, whether that be Moe's or Charlie McCary. And then what I think now would be seen as extremely ridiculous fight sequences, not so much between the main characters and the Native Americans, but between people, between like, you know, fist fights between people. I just, again, kind of tying back to not knowing what is an accurate representation of that time. Do you think that was really cool back then? You know, I have no idea. Like, was that what they wanted? You know, the fight between Charlie and Marty towards the end, it's just so silly and so ridiculous. And I don't know if they were trying to have it be a moment of levity, or did they really think that that was intense and that they were kind of keeping that going throughout? So, you know, I don't know if they were there on purpose to lighten the mood or if that's the best they could do. I don't know. What do you guys think? It took me out of the moment a little bit several times throughout this movie. And I would be something that I think could be improved upon in a big way.
I listened to the running commentary. It was Peter Bogdanovich who did a commentary because he knew John Ford.
Nice.
And he apparently with that scene, that fight scene, that was a conscious choice to make it a little sillier, I guess, and I guess lighten the mood. But I agree with you. I thought it felt out of place and kind of silly. And that was, you know, my biggest problem with the movie is, you know, those moments of humor come in at really weird times.
Yeah.
They're just not timed well, and I'm sure they were funny back then to a certain degree. We're probably commenting on this movie through 21st century eyes, and filmmaking and comedy were very different back then, and they were, you know, portrayed on screen very differently than they are now. But if we were to do a remake, I would want the comedy to be not so broad, you know?
Yeah.
And it definitely time better.
I would just want the comedy, if it was there, to serve more of a purpose.
Yeah.
It seemed so superfluous, and I don't think it furthered any plot, you know?
Yeah. It was almost like the director was like looking for a gag.
I was like,
just to add.
We gotta add 6 minutes to this runtime.
Yeah. Or like, I don't know. I guess like Richard Lester used to do. He's a movie director who was terrible. If you ever saw Superman 3, you know what I'm talking about. He was criticized for that a lot. Like, you know, just always looking for gags and trying to stick comedy in to movies that it wasn't really needed. And that's what I feel like what I guess that's what this kind of reminds me of.
I would rather see it lend to a tone of the film more. And I guess I'm thinking about the Coen Brothers remake of True Grit, where there's a levity, but it's not really comedy. It's more like just this kind of strange air.
Yeah.
And I think that was an approach that worked really well for that remake of a John Wayne film. And I want to rip that off.
That was I agree with you, Mark, because I think that felt very natural to the story
and to the characters.
Yeah, like this is a funny moment that these characters had that I could totally see them having. That was not like, oh, the lighting just changed and now the music just changed and let's have a funny little fight.
Yeah, so it's not a gag. Exactly.
It's a natural moment of levity in a serious situation, as opposed to, we need somebody who's going to come in and start hitting people with a chicken and then start playing Yakety Sax, and it's going to be great because this is too dark right now. We need the audience to take a breath.
Yep. I think one thing from the original that I wouldn't mind holding on to is the character of Moe's. I think he could be portrayed differently and it could be portrayed a little bit more sensitively, but I think it's okay to have somebody that is a very unreliable character, you know, in this case, kind of an unreliable, not narrator, but, you know, I mean, when they eventually come upon him and he directs them to the people who ultimately help him find Scar, you know what I mean? So like, you kind of have to say like, okay, is he crazy or is this actually likely? You know what I mean? Like, I think introducing some uncertainty there, some questioning of his mental acuity, I think is appropriate. So I think some of that stuff works well with his performance, but so much of the other stuff, yeah, I'm in complete agreement with you guys.
One of the things, this is off topic a little bit, but one of the things that in rewatching this movie cracked me up, and I don't think that they were intentional, is there seemed to be a lot of just very goofy ways that it was filmed. The examples that I can think of off the top of my head, the very first scene of the movie when John Wayne is approaching the farmstead and they all go out to the front porch and that's your Uncle Ethan. And you know, they all come out and greet him and he gets off the horse and he comes up and he kisses Martha. No, I can't think of the character's name. He kisses her on the forehead.
Yeah, a couple times he does that.
Yeah. So, but then like this whole family's like this joyous moment and he comes up and he kind of gives her a little hug and he kisses her on the forehead. And then they all sort of walk inside to the farmhouse and she walks backwards staring at him the whole time. If you watch it, she like they have this moment, touching moment, kiss. And then she just sort of starts walking backwards through the door. And it is so bizarre and almost creepy when you watch it, because it's like, what? Why is she doing? How is she doing that?
I can answer that.
Yeah. Well, good.
It's implied that there's a history between her and Ethan.
Yep.
Right.
That there's like some sort of romantic history there.
Essentially that he went away to war for years and she ended up marrying his brother in spite of being in love with him. I think
I get that. But the fact that if you watch it again, just watch the first 5 minutes of the movie, like the way that she walks through the door backwards, this is like, why didn't you just turn around and go inside and continue the party inside? And then there's another scene. The other one that kind of jumped out at me is, there was a couple times when they were in a shootout and it just looked like something went wrong in the shoot, like a gun went off too early or whatever else. And they just sort of look at, like, there's one of them where I think it's the pastor colonel, whatever his name was. And he, like, Ethan tosses him a gun and says, here, it's loaded. And he kind of looks at him and throws his hat at him. And then it goes off. And they kind of look at each other.
Oh, yeah.
They kind of look at each other because it certainly, he wasn't aiming it or making any sort of gesture to fire it. It was just in his hand and, like, the smoke comes out of it. And then he, like, picks it up and starts aiming at the, across the river to start shooting it. And it's just like, it was like a prop malfunction.
I can answer that too. It was a malfunction.
Thank you, Lee.
And he, the director decided to keep it in because he thought it was hilarious.
And I did too, but it was like
different reasons though.
For strange reasons. Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that somebody acknowledged it.
All right. So before we wrap up here, I'm going to include some links in the show notes to articles that I found in doing some research about this movie showing. So this is a segment we're calling Under the Influence. So this is about how The Searchers influenced other movies. And really, the more that I read about this movie and how it was made and the way it was filmed and just like particular shots in it, the more I appreciated it. So I think I have a greater degree of enjoyment of the movie having read this stuff. The one that I first came upon, months ago because it was linked to on a blog that I follow. I can't remember if it was Kotke.org or Kudal, but it's a analysis of shots from The Searchers versus very similar shots in Star Wars. So George Lucas was very much influenced by Western movies in making Star Wars. And there are some shots, the scene where Marty and Ethan get back to the homestead and it's been burned down, compared to when Luke heads back to Owen and Beru's place, and that's in Smoldering Flames. It's not quite shot for shot, but it's very similar. There's a lot of parallels there. So I saw that months ago, and then in reading up more, there's lots of really good features of how The Searchers has influenced lots of directors, lots of movies. Even something as simple and interesting as Ethan uses the line, "That'll be the line, that'll be the day," which Buddy Holly used to create a great song called "That'll Be the Day." I mean, it's just really, really interesting how it has influenced pop culture as a whole and movies, and especially Star Wars. There's a nice analysis of The Searchers in Star Wars Episode 2 as well. For example, when Marty says he's going to try to get Debbie towards the end and they kind of lower him down off a rock, there's almost an exactly same framed shot when Anakin is looking out over the Tusken Raiders and he's going to go in and find his mom. Like, the framing of it is almost exactly the same, except he jumps down because he's a Jedi and Marty's not. But, you know, that's okay. So it's really good stuff. I highly recommend that you look through that. It added to my enjoyment of the film in a really lovely, helpful way. So I would definitely check that out. Anything that you guys want to add to that at all?
I was just to make a continued point from what I had said in the first episode. In watching this again, I really saw a lot of parallels to this story and Moby Dick in how Ethan as Ahab and Scar as the prey, the hunted, you know, this mythic creature that we sort of just see off in the distance most of the time. And then Marty as Ishmael, as kind of the everyman that we see the story through. And it really is, to me, it's a story about this desperate, obsessive vengeance that is very similar in tone and theme to that book. And in my mind, if we did a remake, I think it would, the characters and the feel of the movie would become a lot more about that. And I think that if it was on purpose, great. If it wasn't, then it just sort of accidentally became very thematically similar. But that's how I interpreted it when I watched it the second time around.
Kyle, to your point about the similar shots when they were lowering Marty off the rock and when Anakin was jumping down, when I watched that originally, I was like, oh, cool, they're going to lower him off the rock. And then when he fell, I was like, oh, crap, he's falling a really long way.
Yeah. It's a hell of a drop. Yeah.
It's like, maybe he should have lowered a rope or something. I was just waiting for him to land and kind of give a little yelp of pain or something. But
yeah,
I did not get that. Agreed. I was unsatisfied.
Alas.
Andy, do you Indeed. Desire suffering in others?
I kind of wanted to in him. He was annoying me at that point.
So isolated incidences.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
It's deserved.
Fair enough. I like it. All right, so that wraps it up here for the second half of our discussion of The Searchers. If you'd like to find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast or blog on the Mathis Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. And as discussed, we are going to have detailed show notes for this episode and for part one, if you haven't looked at that too, where you can find information about the actors, actresses, directors, external links, anything that we've discussed here in this episode or first episode. You can go there on mathishard.net and look under the Remakers Mark section. And if you've downloaded this on a podcast client, that will be in there as well. So you can check those out there. On the social media worlds, you can find us on both Twitter and Facebook at username mathishardnet. Our next episode will be released on June 16th, where we will be discussing Three Amigos. So pretty ding dang excited about that. All right, gents, as always, it's been a wonderful time hanging out with you and talking through a new genre for this. That was a good time. I really appreciate that. So until the next time, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.